Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, June 26, 1991.
Madam Chair?
Yep.
All the...
Yeah, oh yeah, no, I'm with you.
Okay, committee will come to order, and we'll start off with a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3444. And let's see, Eric Wasserman? Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Wasserman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Justice Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. You have several items before you regarding House Bill 3444. This, by the way, is filed at the request both of the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The exhibits include handwritten testimony of the Attorney General, Mr. Frohmeyer, which I'll be presenting for him today. There is also a letter to Chairman Cohen written by myself regarding questions of the admissibility of DNA evidence in court. I'm also asking to have distributed to you written testimony by a cell biologist from the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center, Dr. Karen Rodland, which discusses the reliability of DNA evidence. You also have before you amendments prepared recently by the counsel's office. They are the -A4 amendments. Those are the result of discussions between the Department of Justice and the Governor's Office, and we find those amendments acceptable. Have no difficulty with them at all. With one very significant exception that I'll discuss at some greater length later in my testimony, the basic features of House Bill 3444 are substantially similar to a bill that was passed unanimously by this committee in 1989.
Okay.
The problem that it addresses is this one. It is, in fact, every woman's nightmare that she is perhaps awakened in her home at night or attacked on the street by someone she does not know and is raped or sexually attacked by that person. She does not know them, and perhaps in the darkness or because of a hood worn or something of that nature, she cannot identify her sexual attacker. As it stands today, many of those cases cannot be solved. There simply is no way of connecting the unknown attacker with the incident. We hope that House Bill 3444 will be the solution to that kind of problem. Here is how it works. When a person is convicted in an Oregon court of one of the sexual offenses listed in the bill, or a murder or an aggravated murder, the court will order them to submit to the taking of a blood sample. That sample will be taken by competent medical personnel and transmitted to the Oregon State Police Crime Detection Laboratory, and there two lab technicians would create a DNA profile of the blood and store that profile in a computerized data bank. Later, if the individual whose blood was taken committed a sexual offense and left behind blood, flesh, hair, some kind of bodily fluid that contained DNA evidence, that evidence would be submitted to the Crime Detection Laboratory and could be compared with the information in the data bank. And in effect, the case could be solved right there at the laboratory with a match between the evidence from the crime scene and the information in the data bank. This could have a dramatic impact on sex crime investigations for two particular reasons. First of all, As this committee has, I think, repeatedly heard this session, sex offenders repeat their crimes over and over and over again. In addition, sex offenders, rapists in particular, do often leave behind DNA evidence that can be found on the victim's person, most frequently. To this date, 14 other states, to my knowledge, have taken this first step towards investigating crimes in this way. And that list keeps growing by the day. Under leadership of the FBI labs, many states have legislation of this type under consideration at this time. Six other states have taken the additional step of declaring that DNA evidence should be admissible in court, taken the step by statute. Many others have taken that step in court ruling. Section 13 of House Bill 3444 would declare that DNA evidence would be admissible in criminal proceedings to prove the identity of the perpetrator. This is the major difference from the 1989 bill. And I want to stress that we're talking about criminal proceedings because we already have a statute in the states that allows this evidence to be used in paternity proceedings, and its use in paternity proceedings right now is a matter of routine. DNA evidence has already been admitted in three criminal trials in the state of Oregon. It has been presented to the Oregon Court of Appeals. My personal prediction in view of the size of that trial record is that we're talking about at least a year for an opinion from the Oregon Court of Appeals and at least an additional year before we'll have anything from the Oregon Supreme Court regarding admissibility.
Which one is it?
House Bill 3444 would, in Section 13, accelerate the process of declaring evidence of that type to be admissible across the state and criminal courts. These admissibility hearings are very expensive. The prosecution alone in Clatsop County, the primary case that we have now, the one before the Court of Appeals, spent $60,000 to $65,000 paying for transcripts of testimony and expert witness fees and information about what the defense expended for those same types of costs has not been forthcoming from the court administrator's office, but it is fair to say that it was probably comparable. These hearings are very expensive, and what is, I guess, perhaps difficult to justify about the expense is that we are running these expenses up by duplicating the same kind of hearing. As I pointed out in a letter that I wrote to Chairman Cohen, we have had approximately 450 of these admissibility hearings across the country, and less than 10 of these cases have ever resulted in exclusion of the evidence. Almost without exception, trial courts and appellate courts have found this evidence to be reliable. When there has been a problem with admitting the evidence, it almost always has not had anything to do with the reliability of the technology itself. It has been some particular defect in the performance of the test, the individual test by the individual laboratory, or the failure of the prosecutor to simply present enough information to the court about the reliability of DNA testing. When a full and complete record is given to the courts, the evidence simply just comes in. So DNA evidence is going to come in Oregon. I really feel very confident in saying that. It may not come in on the first try in front of our courts, but eventually it will come in because the evidence simply is so powerful and so reliable that our courts will not be able to overlook it. I don't want to overstate for you the cost savings that this admissibility provision would give you. And I want to be very clear to understand DNA evidence is going to be somewhat expensive to present in court with or without this provision. But what you save is the most expensive part, and that is this. Expensive witnesses for the defense and the prosecution who talk to the court about whether or not DNA technology is capable of producing a reliable result. That is the issue that has been litigated over and over and over again in pretrial hearings. this bill would save the bulk of those costs. Mm-hmm. And the additional area in which we experience costs are that we litigate that question in a criminal trial twice. We litigate it first pretrial to determine whether the evidence should come in, and then we go before the jury and we litigate the question all over again as the state tries to prove guilt and the defendant is seeking to establish that this evidence is not reliable enough to prove guilt as a question of weight for the jury. So we litigate these things twice in every criminal case. House Bill 3444 would, we believe, result in significant cost savings, additionally in inducing guilty defendants to plead guilty. DNA evidence was powerful enough to induce one guilty plea in Lincoln County, but I don't believe that we can expect to see too many guilty pleas until the evidence is clearly admissible, either by court ruling from the appellate courts or by the action of this body, the legislature. I would like you to take a moment, if you have time, to look at the written testimony of Dr. Karen Rodlin, who has testified as an expert on this. And as a matter of fact, it's not in her interests to have this bill passed, because there is income that she can make in expert witness fees testifying about the reliability of DNA evidence. But she has presented testimony which is contradicts her own personal financial interests, and she makes clear that there is no significant debate at this time about the reliability of DNA evidence. At this point, I'd like to pass to Major Roger Dingman of the Oregon State Police Crime Lab.
Vice Chairman Hill and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Major Roger Dingman of the Oregon State Police Crime Laboratory Division. Our purpose today is to testify in support of House Bill 3444. Passage of this bill would require convicted sex offenders, murderers, and sex-related offenders presently in the system, and all future sex offenders, murderers, and persons committing sex-related felonies to supply a blood sample for DNA profiling. These profiles would be placed in a data bank for future reference in unsolved rape cases and other related sexual crimes. 14 other states have already implemented this program, while most other states are in the planning stages. Once these data banks are operational, each state will have the ability to cross-check each other's files. Presently, the FBI is coordinating this effort on a nationwide basis. It is well established that sex offenders are repetitive in their offenses and become progressively more violent in time. If implemented, the forensic information obtained may result in cost savings to the citizens of this state. The cost of providing the analytical information may be offset by the decrease in investigative and prosecutorial time. The results are so definitive that a large number of offenders will plead to their offenses, saving valuable court time. It is important to realize that the analytical findings of DNA profiling not only establishes the identity of an offender, but will also clear an innocent suspect. More importantly, passage of this bill to allow DNA profiling will save many of the citizens we serve from traumatic and tragic personal attacks by repeat offenders. For these reasons, I respectfully request your support for this important bill. This concludes my testimony. If there are any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them at this time.
Yes, sir. Any questions? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I have a couple of questions, Mr. Wassman, for clarification's sake. The committee has been handed the A4 amendments, and I should note that even though they're designated A4, they apply equally to the B engrossed version, which came out after the amendments were drafted. But among those amendments are some changes with respect to the offenses that are covered. So for the committee's information, Mr. Wassman, we would, under the amendments, we would be deleting contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, sexual misconduct, and public indecency, except for the offense that involves exposure with the intent to gratify or arouse sexual purposes. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
I think I have those. Oh, here they are. I'm sorry.
And my question for you is, how were these particular offenses selected? Is there literature on sex offenders which sort of indicates that these particular offenses are more likely to occur with sexual predators, or can you describe how these offenses were identified?
Ms. Swenson, as submitted, the bill swept broadly to pick up as broadly as possible sexual offenses. And my thinking was, first of all, that not everything that is sexual in nature, not every crime that's sexual in nature, is necessarily appears in conviction records as a sexual offense. For example, burglary with intent to commit a sexual offense will show up simply as a burglary. So I intended to sweep broadly to capture sexual offenses. The deletion of the three misdemeanors you talked about occurred simply in conversations with the governor's office. They had some difficulty with those sex offenses that consisted of consensual sex between an adult and a person under the age of 18, and simply that. And also in the public indecency area, sexual activity in a public place. They had a problem including those sex offenses as not being very predictive of future sexual aggression. I've tried to sweep broadly, and my thinking here is that so many sex offenses are committed by a sex offender that are never reflected in arrest, never reflected in conviction, and sexual behavior among sex offenders indicates a variety of sexual contact, so that the one arrest we have may be an exposure, whereas the future crime that we may be trying to apprehend them for may be rape. I've tried to err on the side of protecting the public against sex offenders and scoop in as many as possible. Deleting these three was not necessarily my personal choice, but we're willing to live with that.
May I ask one?
Yes, go ahead.
So is there sexual offender literature, basically, which indicates that these particular offenses are predictive of sexual aggression?
I cannot point you, Ms. Swenson, to literature regarding these particular three offenses.
I mean any of these offenses that are described in the measure.
Any offenses on the entire list?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, certainly. And this committee has had considerable information about that, I believe. The two studies that were most persuasive to me in this legislation were a report about self-reported sex crimes of non-incarcerated offenders by Dr. Gene Abel and others. It was presented to this committee, I think, by Dr. Lauren Bays. Of 561, I believe, non-incarcerated sex offenders reported a total of 291,000 sexual acts, deviant sexual acts. A similar study conducted in the Oregon Probation Sex Offender Unit and reported in a brief report by Roger Little indicated that among 35 people in the Oregon State Hospitals program, they admitted to several thousand aggressive sexual acts, and I believe 10,000 or more acts of peeping Tom, exposure, and the more minor things. So those kinds of things I found very persuasive in drafting a broad and all-inclusive list.
May I ask one other question, Senator Hill? The promoting and compelling prostitution, are those offenses traditionally listed among those predictive of sexual aggression?
I cannot recall whether I've seen them in those lists. I have anecdotal experience of its connection with sexual violence. Our office has recently handled the retrial of Jesse Pratt in Klamath County. He had been sentenced to death for a sexual homicide That conviction was reversed. Your case was retried, and our office did a second attempt to uncover his personal history, and the personal history was so extensive, it was shocking. First of all, it had very little to do with the actual arrest and conviction record. There was so much there in terms of violence against former girlfriends, former wives, but one of the things that really stuck out was that he consistently engaged in compelling prostitution of his wives and girlfriends. When he needed some money at a truck stop, whatever, by threat or violence, he would compel them to prostitute themselves. And that that was significant for me in realizing that compelling prostitution isn't necessarily always an isolated business-like offense as it might be supposed.
Thank you.
Yes, any other questions? If you have, Eric, you said that this evidence, there's a way of getting this into court now. And I want to know, why is it that you want to change it specifically? Why is it the way that it is, and why do you want it changed?
Vice Chairman Hill, the way of getting it into court right now is that the state must litigate pre-trial whether or not DNA analysis is capable of producing reliable results that will be relevant and persuasive to the fact finder. And as I said, that's just enormously expensive. The change we anticipate is this, that the issue of DNA reliability would move from a pretrial hearing to where we believe it belongs and where it eventually will end up, and that is an issue to be litigated, if at all, before the jury. As it stands now, we litigate it twice in the case. First for the judge pretrial on a, as a question of admissibility. And underlying the request for that change in process is our belief that DNA evidence is coming. There won't be a court in 10 years that would want to be identified as saying this evidence is not reliable. It's just so powerful.
Where do you litigate, or where do you determine whether the test was properly administered, the procedures were properly administered? Is that pretrial? I mean, you want to do that.
Vice Chairman Hill, that's a difficult question to answer. It could be litigated either pretrial or during the trial. At pretrial, it would be a question of admissibility, and that question could be deferred until the trial stage, or it could be litigated in front of the jury as a question of the weight to be given the evidence. And I have seen questions about scientific tests litigated both ways, and I think I provided some examples of that in there. But those questions are more narrow and not nearly as time-consuming or as expensive to litigate. So if the particular judge chooses to litigate pre-trial whether this particular lab adequately followed procedures, adequately obtained their result, that's something we expect to litigate in court either pre-trial or in front of the jury or during the course of the trial before the jury hears it. That's not going to go away with this bill, and it shouldn't.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Yeah, looking over the staff measure summary, and I haven't found it in the bill, it mentions here that regarding juveniles found within the jurisdiction of the court for any of the listed felony offenses, be required to submit a blood sample, and that blood sample would not be expunged, period. I read it right. Now, what happens if the juvenile is not found guilty of the felony with which he's charged?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the finding that he is within the jurisdiction of the court is, in effect, a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty. That's what the finding in juvenile court is called. We don't call finding the child guilty. We call it finding the child within the jurisdiction of the court.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, but if the Court of Appeals would reverse that determination that the juvenile was within the jurisdiction of the court, again, there's no provision for amending the record. Okay. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that should be in there, and I would welcome your correction of that oversight.
Yes, any other questions?
If I may,
yes, please go ahead.
I have yet another, Mr. Wassman. I'm looking at page 3 of the B. Engross version of the bill, and specifically subsection 5 of section 4, which deals with the removal of DNA data if a person is has a conviction reversed and vacated. And in line 18 on page 3, it says, whenever a court, quote, reverses and vacates the conviction or order, then this provision takes effect. And I guess I'm a little troubled by that language, wondering if it covers, for example, the relief that might be provided in a post-conviction proceeding or some proceeding other than a direct appeal that results in reversal and vacation of the conviction. Can you comment on that?
Ms. Swenson, you addressed this question briefly with me just before the hearing, and I tried to imagine ways to cover the situations you were talking about. If the word reverses does not include post-conviction, I'm not sure whether or not at this point that it does. I certainly would have no problem with including post-conviction relief within this provision. I guess what I'm getting at here is that cases are frequently reversed and sent back for retrial, and it didn't seem appropriate that we be destroying a record in the database if, in fact, we're going back for retrial and retrial subsequently results in a conviction. But perhaps what we would put in here is that it's reversed on appeal or post-conviction and the conviction is vacated, or the person obtains a court order for destruction of the record. And then that would leave to the trial court discretion about whether destruction was appropriate in this case. If a case was a live criminal case was still pending and likely the conviction or possible the conviction would be obtained, then the destruction order could be denied by the trial court. And that would also preserve the state police's interest, because if in fact the sample were destroyed under court order and a conviction subsequently obtained, then the police would be able to get the sample after that.
Thank you.
Yes, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Dave Podanke. Sure.
Good afternoon. I'm Ross Shepard. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The areas of this bill that I wish to address are sections 12 and 13 dealing with the automatic admissibility of the DNA test. As you've heard, this bill would modify Chapter 136 to say that the analysis of DNA is admissible without question. It would effectively eliminate all pretrial litigation, and I suggest to you that in this type of case, pretrial litigation is absolutely crucial to the fair use of DNA. I'm not today objecting to the technology itself, but I think what I need to stress to you is that we need an analysis by a judge before a jury is impaneled over how the test was done in that specific case for a judge to make a ruling of whether that testing is in fact relevant as a matter of law and can be presented to the jury. And if you were to adopt this bill as it presently stands, we'd be doing away with that process. I can envisage a situation where the state's analyst would even acknowledge that the test was done improperly, but that person would still be allowed to testify to the jury that notwithstanding the problems we had with the testing, there is a 40 million to 1 chance that somebody other than the defendant committed this crime. And in this DNA arena, we will be dealing with numbers like that. The defense could then put on experts saying, yes, there were problems with the testing, but we'll know which evidence is going to stick in the jury's mind, and that's the 40 million to one. This person's going to be found guilty even if there were severe difficulties with the testing. So we need a fine-tooth comb in this DNA area, and all we're asking you to do is to leave the law as it presently stands and where it should stand. And that would be by deleting the last two sections of the bill. You have an amendment which does that. I don't know how it's denominated, but I'd ask you to look favorably upon that.
He's referring to the B5.
B5.
So, any questions? Shepard, I guess I wanted to, but as I understand, part of the procedure now is that they litigate the validity of the of DNA evidence, period.
I think that has been done in some cases, but Senator, I think that's it may be part of the technology itself may be part and parcel of the discussion of the testing that was done in the individual case. I think
thank you. Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob June.
I see that you were originally signed up against the original bill here, or it's, maybe you're still against what Section 22.
Given the changes, Madam Chair, we have no opposition to the bill. The only point, clarification, two points of clarification, one being that this would address the situation where a person was in one health care facility who needed psychiatric treatment on a hold and needed to be brought to another. And right now, it's very cumbersome to make that happen. Our only concern would be that in earlier part of the section, which says that in no case shall a person be held in a hospital for longer than 5 judicial days without a hearing, it would be that would be understood to cover both hold situations, both the two-physician hold situation and the additional time covered by the transport hold. With that understanding, I think that this version will work quite well.
Okay, thank you. That question.
Couple of questions of Steve. The proposed amendments reduce from 24 hours to 12 hours the time after the examination that may elapse before the statement is made, and also limits to 12 hours the amount of time that this person can be held before being transported. I guess I have two questions. One, is that workable? And secondly, do you need as long as 12 hours?
Madam Chair, Senator, the practical standpoint, at least within the problems I'm aware of within our system, is that 12 hours is certainly ample time. I think we're trying to write this in a way that will also reflect circumstances elsewhere in the state other than just the Portland metropolitan area, and I think we've all agreed that 12 hours isn't an appropriate time.
Okay.
And will work. And the purpose of having it in both sections is to make sure it's consistent, so we don't say 6 in one and 12 in another.
Just for my own, just to be sure I understand, we now would refer to that you can hold this person in a healthcare facility licensed under ORS 431, Chapter 431. What is that?
Purpose, Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the purpose of that is to confine this hold to a licensed hospital, which
words,
is the reference here, rather than a physician's office or jail or some other place. We want to confine this really just to hospitals so that we're solving the hospital-to-hospital transport problem.
Okay. These are... just hospitals?
Well,
or all healthcare facilities? Like
any licensed healthcare facility, keeping in mind that you still have to have a physician within that healthcare facility making the initial examination and requesting the transport. I'm not aware of any other facilities outside of hospitals that would fall under this this intent.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
Are we ready to move? Are there any other witnesses?
Dave Fidenke, it was signed up in opposition to the bill.
He's okay.
Well, I assume he had concerns with the original bill. Okay, then I think we do have the amendments.
Madam Chair,
let's see where they are, right here.
And you have a hand engrossed version, and I have a couple of suggested additions to that.
Okay.
One, I think the reference to ORS 431 probably ought to be ORS Chapter 431. That's just technical. I think the reference to says may hold this person for up to 12 hours for transporting to a treatment facility. I think we ought to tie that in with the type of facility that this section 426175 is limited to, as described in subsection 3, which is a hospital or other facility which maintains adequate staff facilities for care and treatment of the mentally ill and is approved by the division. I think we ought to make sure that that is the facility to which transport may be made. And finally, in the new sub C about the written statement, to include a statement about the belief of the person's danger, we need to proceed that way of saying the physician believes.
Got it, Bill?
Mm-hmm. Got it. So with those additions, I would move the committee council amendments.
Yes. The committee council amendments as handed gross and further refined by yourself at the moment, okay? Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
And I would then move. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay, you've got fun. I missed a discussion on this bill. And I say, well, I guess I would assume that the ACLU is not opposed to this bill.
Well, they are very opposed to the original bill in its original form, as was the Mental Health Association and a series of other people who I see shaking their heads back there.
Yeah.
And I have made commitments to the sponsors of the original bill that we would try to work throughout the interim to see if we could figure out some way to resolve the issue and the problems that they are concerned about vis-a-vis last stage alcohol and drug people that we need to try to get to some help.
So this
or
is
some
involuntary.
Shelter. Yes, so we have removed all of that section of the bill. We have what is before us is a very almost entirely unrelated that deals with transporting people who are mentally ill from one hospital to the other.
Okay. I feel better.
Yes. We are not going to step out, beyond where we need to be. Yes. The last section. Section 22 of the bill reworked.
We have a room full of conferees waiting for us, by the way.
Yeah, they will.
So, Madam Chair, with that, I would then move House Bill 2944 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Shoemaker's moved the amended House Bill 2944 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. There are no surprises in this.
Okay. Madam Chair,
yes.
If you've got four votes, I'd rather pass
this. That's fine. I don't have a problem at all with you doing that. Yeah, I think there have been the people here who were on a piece of it one way or another. And
well, I was going to do that, Madam Chair, but I see you need the vote, so I'll do that.
We need to excuse, and with the simple understanding that any of you who've looked it over, you can...
We can return.
Okay. Call roll, please, on Senator Shoemaker's motion. Please, Mark.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. And we'll just excuse Senator Bunn from the vote on this. Missed the entire debate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The motion is passed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, there's a conference committee now on Bill 3594 in room 454, which three of us are conferees at. But I could go up to be the wish of the committee and conduct some testimony that's needed by the House conferees, which we don't need. I would like to have Ingrid's help on. And then.
Why would you need Ingrid's help?
To explain the law about implied consent and how it works about taking breath tests and all those kinds of things.
Well.
They don't understand.
It's 3495.
3495, yeah.
Okay.
I keep getting those numbers back. Yes.
I would then, we have one big bill left. We have to take action on House Bill 3444. In some manner, shape, or form,
yeah.
With the four amendments and the possible five amendments and whatever else you all want to talk about. I want to have that discussion when we can round people up and have, if we could.
I think it's too important a bill to leave for the session.
So I'm not suggesting that we leave it. I just want to have a full discussion with the members present. So that we can have that. And we have a bill 2585, which we absolutely cannot leave, which is very extensive and very problematic, that we need our members here to deal with, 2585. So I would propose that we recess until after we get onto the floor at the session, see if we can get excused during the session, come back and take up that so we can clear off some of these conference committees, get on with our business. And do you have a conference committee, Bun? Honor is to come to in the House.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Judiciary Committee will come back into order, and we're going to take up 2585. I'm not sure whether we even have what we need to have here, but I think I have. Do we have extra bills?
Thank you.
We do.
Yeah, it would be.
It would be nice.
Does that include the handing bills?
It includes everything
good.
That I've got.
That's great. Thank you. This
because
is wonderful.
Because we are now at a point where it's hard for our staff to keep up with us.
And
where we are with these.
So is this the one we just have to do?
Yeah. It's the one we have to do. Okay. We may as well have Joan point. We don't have Rosanna isn't here and Fidanki isn't here. So come on, Joan. So we'll rely on Joan and Ingrid and whoever else wants to communicate with us on that. Joan.
Hey, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Joan Plank with the Motor Vehicles Division. House Bill 2585B engrossed is Oregon's bill to comply with recent federal legislation requiring states to suspend driving privileges of persons convicted of drug offenses. It requires courts to order the suspension of driving privileges when a person is convicted of any offense involving manufacturing, possession, or delivery of controlled substances. The bill as written, and I understand there may be amendments, requires courts to order the Motor Vehicles Division to suspend driving privileges of persons convicted of drug offenses for 6 months for a first offense, 3 years for a second, and 5 years for a third or subsequent order. It also currently contains provisions for earlier reinstatement on the 3 and 5 year suspensions upon successful completion of a drug intervention program. The federal law requires the withholding of 5% of federal highway funds from states that do not comply with the federal law by October 1st of 1992. The estimated loss to the highway fund is about $11 million in 93-95, and it doubles to $22 million in 95-97. A state can avoid withholding of the federal highway fund if it passes a drug suspension law meeting federal requirements, and this bill does that, or if the governor certifies in writing that the governor is opposed to compliance, and each house of the state legislature adopts a resolution expressing opposition to compliance. This bill is important to maintain the federal highway dollars. We urge your passage of this proposal, although the amendments I'm aware of, we have no objection to, and are probably a good idea.
One.
Do we know how many highway dollars we're talking about?
$11 million.
For the first year.
A year.
For the first biennium? 93-95 biennium, Madam Chair.
Okay. Let's turn to Ingrid and talk about, Ingrid's been working on this bill for probably a couple of weeks in preparation for our understanding what's going to be asked of us here. So let's have Ingrid go through.
Madam Chair and members, you should have a hand-engrossed version of the bill, which is a hand-engrossed version of the B engrossed bill. It's dated June 26th, and that should reflect the B4 amendments. And what these amendments propose to do is to comply in all respects with the federal mandate, but not exceed anything in the federal mandate. So they would do the following. On page 1 of the hand-engrossed bill, in the part labeled Section 2, the first line of that section talks about compelling circumstances. This would basically permit a court where there were compelling circumstances not to suspend a person's driving privileges. So in each case, a court would have the option of not ordering a suspension if it found compelling circumstances. Down below in sub B in this section 2, it includes driving under the influence of intoxicants as another offense for which suspension will be required. The federal mandate makes specific reference to driving under the influence of intoxicants when the intoxicant is a controlled substance as one of the offenses which must be covered in order to comply with the federal law. On page 1A, on line 18, the language delivery, manufacture, or possession of controlled substances is added. This is added to the provision which permits the court to suspend the driving privileges of juveniles. And the current language talks about offenses involving the possession, use, or abuse of alcohol or controlled substances. And this language is merely to separate out the controlled substance offenses from the use and abuse of alcohol, which really don't describe similar offenses in the controlled substance area. The next change appears on page 3 of the bill in line 6. In lines 5 through 7, and those lines would be deleted. The bill as drafted basically said that there would be no hearing, and by deleting that language, current law would apply, which would include an option for a limited hearing, and if Senate Bill 1212 were to pass, an administrative review rather than a limited hearing. Then in lines 13 through 23, the material which is deleted adds additional suspensions for second and third offenses, and that is not included in the federal mandate, so this is deleted. And then finally on page 5,
I'm down to 13% of people who will be eligible to have a driver's license in this state. I've been counting, keeping tab through all these bills.
On page 5, probably most significant impact of the amendments is in what is now Section 7. And what that does is require in the prosecution...
Golf carts.
I'm on page 5.
Okay.
In Section 7. Require in the prosecution of a driving under the influence case for the state to allege and prove that the driver was under the influence of controlled substances. Currently, these cases are prosecuted as driving under the influence of intoxicants, and the jury can convict based on evidence showing there might be drugs and alcohol, one or the other or both, and no specificity is required. And in order to limit the application of this suspension to those persons who are driving under the influence of controlled substances to comply with the federal act, it will be necessary for that distinction to be made. And practically, apparently what that means for the district attorneys is that currently they prosecute based on the citation issued by the arresting officer rather than issue a formal complaint or charging instrument. In those cases where the police report indicates the presence of a controlled substance, they would now be required to file a complaint rather than prosecute on the basis of the citation. They're not particularly happy with that. I spoke with Fred Lenzer of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, but on the other hand, could not think of another approach that would be less onerous to them. And at least Mr. Lenzer indicated to me that the number of these cases is relatively small compared to the number of DUII.
Okay, does anyone want... Would anyone like to speak to these amendments? Yes, Terry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Terry Rogers from the Governor's Office, and I do want to commend Ingrid on the drafting of the amendments. The governor's position is that we very much need to have this bill in order to protect the highway funds, but we certainly wanted to do nothing more than what the federal law required. And I think that Ingrid has done a very fine job at that, and I would ask your support and prompt passage of the bill.
Thank you. Anyone else who'd like to speak with the amendments, to the amendments, to the, with the, they have been, reviewed, Ingrid, by any number of people, I'm assuming, who would come forward and circulate these around. Well, folks, we have...
All right, Madam Chair, I'll move the House
Bill
2585 B4 amendment.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved the House Bill 2585 B4 amendments, as Ingrid has just shared with us in the and also the hand gross by staff bill. Are there objections to those amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay.
Well then, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2585.
Madam Chair,
as amended to the floor, please pass. Ingrid,
I beg your pardon. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Good.
And I'll move it. I could recommend its removal.
It's already been there.
Yes. Yeah.
And probably should.
Given the stage.
Okay.
I'd even care.
Yeah, I got a bill I need to get
okay.
in there. So
maybe
let
Brockman carry. This would be a good bill for Brockman.
Well, I'm going to vote no because I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
2585 as amended to put forward with the recommendation that we have a letter to rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, and I do want to, again, personally thank Ingrid for all,
yes.
all the efforts that we started on this, and it was, you know, real.
Madam Chair, what percentage of the people driving around there out there does this now bring us to?
I'm at 13. I guess I announced that earlier. You missed my grand announcement.
Long term, we don't get in the car business.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2585 as we've amended it to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a letter to the President and Springer's volunteer.
Couldn't we stick forfeiture in this too?
Madam Chair?
No.
Yes. Senator Schumer just pointed out that I was co-sponsor on this.
Maybe I should carry.
I'll flip you for it.
No, it's okay.
Okay, roll, please.
You made it a much better.
Senator Brockman.
I guess.
Senator Shoemaker.
Yes.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
No, it's not DNA.
Aye. No, this is get some more drugs. This is the suspend your license. This is the suspend your license bill. Mm.
This is dead on arrival.
This is
No. Should have been.
Okay. Bun wants to vote no. Hanby, how do you vote? Do you want to vote?
I didn't really want to vote either, but...
What was the motion? To table? No, then I just walked in, so... What was the motion?
We've adopted the amendments, pared down, and we passed it to pass.
You gotta get the money.
No.
You guys have won me over.
Minority report?
I told them we had to get the money. They won me over.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are finished with that roll call. Okay, now let's go back to our 3444.
Well, there will be a new staff measure analysis.
Yes, that's 11 million buttons.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, but I can't interrupt.
We're doing it for federal dollars.
Oh, well, I'll read it when that's
the federal.
The feds made us do it?
Minimum. Yeah. And they added nothing more.
Get civil liberties, so do what the feds say.
I think we're doing what we have to do. Nothing more than that. The feds made us do it.
Got to keep that federal highway fund flowing in here.
Mm-hmm. Money.
Okay, 3444. We had amendments. Folks.
Yes, I agree.
We have before us the dash
A4
amendments, which are which deal with the, with amendments that have been prepared with Ingrid and the governor's office and interested parties in this bill. To this bill, we had testimony on it, and
Madam Chair, I would we'll take them one at a time, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Move the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 3444.
Thank you. Are there objections to the A4 amendments to House Bill 3444 that Senator Hill has moved? Hearing that, it's ordered. Okay.
Madam Chair, then I would move the dash B5 amendments as well, Madam Chair.
Okay. The dash B5 amendments before us take out the section that deals with admissibility into the courts, leaves it up to the court, and especially the Supreme Court eventually to deal with it. So that's what we have here. We had comments from the governor's office that said, you know, they would accept the bill either way, and that's where we are. Any further discussion?
On the bill?
On the B5 amendment?
No.
Call.
You didn't know that.
Are there objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
In your absence, the committee heard some testimony regarding another portion of the bill, and that's on page 3 of the engrossed version of the bill, line 5, where it says, whenever a court reverses and vacates the conviction or order that created an obligation to provide a blood sample and then provides for the person seeking to have that.
Where is this, Ingrid?
I'm sorry, it's on page 3 of the Dean Gross Bill, subsection 5, line 18.
Oh, sub 5.
Did I say, I'm sorry.
You said line 5.
Yeah. Okay.
And the language reverses and vacates would seem to limit the court's ability to order that this information and evidence be destroyed to those cases where there was a reversal on appeal and a vacation of the conviction. And in speaking with Mr. Wassman about it, if the language "and vacates" were deleted, that would broaden it to permit courts in post-conviction cases as well as in appeals and possibly in habeas corpus proceedings to reverse a conviction without necessarily vacating it. The recommendation at this point would be to delete the language "and vacates" so as not to limit it to just those situations where the conviction is reversed on appeal. A second concern related to juveniles and whether or not if a juvenile were found not to be within the jurisdiction of the court on an appeal, whether that was covered. And in speaking with Mr. Wassman, I believe that the language, that the word "order" in line 18 covers the juvenile, because that's an order of adjudication, and if the order were reversed, that would permit the juvenile to request that that information about that person be removed. And then finally, the other group with whom we're concerned is the persons who are adjudicated guilty except for insanity. And it's not considered a conviction. And consequently, if we inserted the word "judgment" after the word "conviction," that would clarify that those persons are also entitled to seek to have this information deleted should their adjudication be reversed on appeal. So that line 18 would then read, whenever a court reverses the conviction, judgment, or order that created an obligation.
Madam Chair, what would happen if you had a reversal and retrial? Would that cause that information to be lost?
And Madam Chair, what would basically happen would be that the person could, after the reversal, could then apply to have the specimen removed and be subject to having it taken again, or could not apply and see what happened on retrial, and if on retrial there was a reconviction, not have to go through the blood test procedure again. That's what would be contemplated.
Thank you. Eric, comment, please.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that a change would also need to be made on line 22, where it says court order reversing and vacating. The words "and vacating" should come out if you're going to do that amendment.
Thank you. Are there
In what